Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, November 15th, 2023. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Let's take a look at the front page of today's Sioux City Journal. The front page features, most of the front page is taken up by a photograph of, and the caption is, Kim Taylor and her defense attorney and an unidentified woman walked toward the federal courthouse in Sioux City on Monday. The headline is, Ballot Irregularities Prompted Call to FBI. And the subtitle is, Auditor Pat Gill Called Authorities About Absentee Ballots. This is from Dateline Sioux City. It's written by Tim Hines of the Journal. As Woodbury County election workers processed absentee ballots during the June 2020 primary election, they alerted their boss to what they considered an unusual number of write-in votes on Republican ballots cast for Jeremy Taylor for both county board and county auditor and recorder. Woodbury County auditor and recorder Pat Gill, who also is the election commissioner, said handwriting on the ballots looked similar, but since the ballots had been separated from the envelopes bearing the voters' signatures, it was impossible to tell who had submitted the ballots and follow up on any suspicions, Gill said. Quote, it looked like something was going on, but at that point there was nothing I could do, Gill testified Tuesday, which was the second day of a federal trial in Sioux City in which Taylor's wife, Kim Taylor, faces 52 charges related to voter fraud. A few months later, just before the general election, Gill had suspicious ballots he could trace, and he reported it to the FBI. Prosecutors allege the ensuing investigation uncovered a scheme in which Kim Taylor fraudulently filled out voter registration forms, absentee ballot request forms, and cast absentee ballots on behalf of voters in Woodbury County's Vietnamese community in order to secure votes for her husband, Jeremy Taylor, who ran unsuccessfully for the Republican nomination for a U.S. House seat in the 2020 primary election and was elected to the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors in that fall's general election. Kim Taylor has pleaded not guilty, and her attorney, in his opening statement to jurors, denied there was any scheme. Jeremy Taylor, who met his wife in Vietnam when he was teaching there, has not been charged, but has been named an unindicted co-conspirator. In late October 2020, Gill said he was contacted by Tam Doan, that's D-O-A-N, a Sioux City resident who said she had tried to request an absentee ballot but was told she'd already returned a completed one. Gill met with Doan and her brother, Tien Doan, who was living in Ames, where he attended college. He said he had also not received a requested ballot. Gill said he found the returned ballots, and both voters said they had not filled them out. As his sister testified a day earlier, Tien Doan testified on Tuesday that the signature on the voter affidavit accompanying the ballot and shown to him in court was not his, and the ballot was marked in favor of Donald Trump for president. Quote, I had no intention of voting for Donald Trump in that election, said Doan, who is a registered Democrat. Gill had Tom and Tien Doan, who both moved to the United States from Vietnam as children with their parents, sign forms invalidating the completed ballots and gave them new ones, which they filled out at the courthouse and returned. Gill kept the invalidated ballots, later turning them over to the FBI. Tam and Tien Doan's mother, Yong Nguyen, testified that she had filled out the ballots on their behalf with help from Kim Taylor. A Vietnam native who immigrated to the United States in 2002, Nguyen said she has limited ability to read, write, or speak English and needs help filling out documents. She usually has her children or another friend help her, she said through an interpreter. Nguyen said she'd never met Kim Taylor before Taylor called to offer her help with voting. Nguyen said Taylor filled out the voter registration forms and absentee request forms for the primary election for her and her children. Nguyen said she signed them on her children's behalf. Quote, whatever forms she helped me fill out, I would sign, she said. The quote continues, I asked Kim if it was okay for me to sign, and she said it was okay, so I signed, unquote. Prior to the general election, Taylor visited again and helped Yen fill out absentee ballot requests for her and her children, weeks before Tam Doan made her own absentee request for the family. After the absentee ballots arrived, they disappeared one day, Tam Doan testified. Nguyen said Taylor had come to her home and helped her fill them out without her children's knowledge or permission. Taylor then took them and dropped them off at the courthouse, and Nguyen said told her not to tell her children what had happened to their ballots. Quote, she told me if Tam asked about them to tell her I don't know, so I lied, Nguyen said. When my daughter asked, Kim had already helped me fill out those forms. It led to Doan's inquiry and discovery at Gill's office that ballots had already been returned in her and her brother's names. After the general election was over, Gill said he contacted the FBI to report the irregularities involved with Tam and Tian Doan's ballots. Gill said he's never talked to Kim Taylor, but knew she was active helping people register to vote, obtain absentee ballots, and vote. He said he'd heard complaints about Taylor's activities. Quote, people felt she was pretty aggressive, Gill said under cross-examination from Taylor's attorney, F. Montgomery Brown. The quote continues, what I would say is it's a get-out-the-vote effort and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it, unquote. Brown questioned Gill, the lone Democrat holding an elected Woodbury County office, extensively about his role in a citizen's challenge of Jeremy Taylor's voter registration in late 2019, when Taylor was on the county board. Gill upheld the challenge, finding Taylor did not live at the address listed on his voter registration and therefore was disqualified from holding office because his voter registration address was not within the district he represented as required by state law. Taylor resigned from office but was elected months later to represent the district in which his new home was located. Gill, who testified for more than 3 hours on Tuesday, will return to the witness stand for more cross-examination when the trial resumes on Wednesday. Our next story from the front page, arrest made in death of ex-muskie cut by skate. And it shows a photograph of a hockey player. Dateline, Sheffield, England. Police arrested a man Tuesday on suspicion of manslaughter in the death of former Sioux City Musketeers player Adam Johnson, whose neck was cut by a skate during a game in England. Johnson, age 29, was playing for the Nottingham Panthers against the Sheffield Steelers on October 28 when a skate blade cut his neck in the Elite Ice Hockey League game at Sheffield's Utilita Arena. South Yorkshire Police did not name the suspect or provide his age. He was in police custody. Matt Petgrave, age 31, who plays for Sheffield, was the other player involved in the grisly incident that reverberated around the hockey community and led to moments of silence in the NHL. Video of the incident shows Johnson skating with the puck toward the Steelers' net. Petgrave skates toward Johnson and collides with another Panthers player. Petgrave's left skate kicks up as he begins to fall, and the blade hits Johnson in the neck. Both players land on the ice. Petgrave immediately got to his feet. Johnson rose more slowly, and as he is helped off the ice, his jersey is covered in blood. He later died at a local hospital. Quote, our investigation launched immediately following this tragedy, and we have been carrying out extensive inquiries ever since to piece together the events which led to the loss of Adam in these unprecedented circumstances, said Detective Chief Superintendent Bex Horsfall. A Hibbing, Minnesota native, Johnson played for the Sioux City Musketeers from 2013 to 2015. He was named to the Muskies All-Decade Team during its 50th anniversary season. Johnson appeared in a total of 13 NHL games with the Pittsburgh Penguins in the 2018-19 and 2019-20 seasons. The English Ice Hockey Association, which governs the sport below the Elite League, reacted to Johnson's death by requiring all players in England to wear neck guards from the start of 2024. On Sunday, at the Steelers' first home game since Johnson's death, a moment of silence was held for him. Pettgrave did not play in the game, but fans gave him a standing ovation when his team photo appeared on the scoreboard. It would be rare but not unprecedented for a hockey player to be charged. Jacinto Jim Bonney was charged in Italy with culpable homicide after he slashed Moran Schrott in the chest during a game on January 14, 1992. Schrott died as a result of a cardiac event. Bonney pleaded guilty to manslaughter. Two NHL players in recent history have been charged with a crime in Canada for an on-ice action. They are Marty McSorley and Todd Bertuzzi. In 2000, McSorley was found guilty of assault with a deadly weapon for a two-handed slash to the head of Donald Brashear with his stick. He was sentenced to 18 months probation. In 2004, Bertuzzi pleaded guilty to assault for grabbing Steve Moore from behind and sucker punching him. Bertuzzi agreed to a plea deal and was sentenced to 1 year probation and 80 hours of community service. The Panthers said on X, formerly known as Twitter, that Johnson died tragically following a, quote, freak accident. Nottingham teammate Weston Michaud, who posted tributes to Johnson, also defended Pettgrave for what he said was an unintentional clip with the other player that uprighted him. Quote, "The hate that Matt is receiving is terrible and completely uncalled for," Michaud posted. The quote continues, "It's clear to me his actions were unintentional, and anyone suggesting otherwise is mistaken. Let's come together and not spread unwarranted hate to someone who needs our support," unquote. A spokesman for the EIHL said the league cannot comment on an ongoing police investigation. A Nottingham Panthers spokesman said the organization had no comment. Messages seeking comment sent to Johnson's agent, who is a friend of the family, and Pettgrave's team were not immediately returned. Third story from the front page. Sioux City School Board denies land purchase in Morningside area for combined Sunnyside, Nodland. And it shows a picture of Nodland Elementary School. Dateline Sioux City. The Sioux City Community School District voted against purchasing land formerly known as the Southern Hills Country Club for combined Sunnyside and Nodland Elementary School. The 43 acres of land is located at 2900 South St. Aubin, 2832 South Patterson Street, and 4243 Lincoln Way. It would have cost the district $457,000 and would have been used for a combined Sunnyside and Nodland facility. The board held a public hearing for the purchase on Monday. After the hearing, the board denied purchasing the land in a 1-5 vote, with President Dan Greenwell the lone vote in favor of purchasing the land. Multiple citizens spoke against the purchase of the property, expressing concerns about the cost of preparing the land for a school and the impact of a future combination of Sunnyside and Nodland Elementary Schools. Neighbors of the property said it has not been developed on for 20 years due to the layout of the land and the potential cost of preparing it. They asked if the district had done any research on the property and the cost. Some of the concerns they laid out included the soil makeup, flooding, grading cost, and entrance for traffic. Tim Paul, the district's operations and maintenance director, said district staff, in partnership with DGR Engineering, has been working to review the property over the last few weeks, as well as a traffic study that was conducted. He said that based on the layout of the land, it would be best to build a school similar to Perry Creek Elementary, which is one level, with an entrance and exit on Lincoln Way. He said there is a flat area on the northern side of the property that could be viable for the school, with the rest of the lands being used for fields, parking lots, and roadways. He added the project would involve a lot of grading work. Paul said there is not another parcel of land like the former golf course in Morningside for the same price. He said if the district were to decide to expand the Sunnyside lot by purchasing people's homes, it would be financially comparable or more expensive. Sunnyside Elementary is located at 2700 South Maple Street, and Nodland Elementary is next door at 3300 South Cypress Street. Nodland is pre-K through second grade. Sunnyside is third through fifth grades. Earlywine said Sunnyside and Nodland are the only separate elementary schools in the district, and combining them would make the elementary schools consistent throughout the city. Sean Olorundami spoke against the combination of Sunnyside and Nodland, sharing that research shows when schools combine elementary schools, there is a negative impact on behaviors, academics, and it says and academics again. Olorundami said combining neighborhood elementary schools into larger schools is one of the worst decisions the district has made. He suggested the district spend the money on renovating the current Nodland and Sunnyside schools, as well as focusing on continuing to update the three 50-year-old high schools. Paul previously said the district had been looking for land in the Morningside area because the Sunnyside site would be too small for a new facility. The prospect of purchasing the land was brought forward at the previous school board meeting. Superintendent Rod Earlywine said when the opportunity was brought forward to him, he said it was a no-brainer to look at. While the land has not been developed since the golf course closed, Paul said the property just recently became available for purchase, and there have been multiple people interested in purchasing it. Earlywine added the opportunity will be gone if the district waits to purchase. Board members voiced their concerns with the site, stating they would rather wait and do research instead of rushing the purchase. Board member Bob Michelson said he would rather wait and lose the opportunity than not spend adequate time researching the land. Other board members echoed his concerns. Board member Bernie Scolaro said at first she thought it was a good deal, but after looking at the property and thinking about it more, she believes the district has not had an opportunity to do their due diligence. Previously, the school board members spoke positively about the prospect of purchasing new land in the Morningside area. However, after hearing from the community, many board members voiced concern about the land and the seemingly fast process. And then there are some overhead drawings, overhead photographs accompanying this article that show some of the proposed pieces of property in question. Enter page to news briefs. First is a man sentenced for sexual contact with child. Dateline Storm Lake. A Lakeside, Iowa man was sentenced Monday to 10 years in prison for having sexual contact with a 9-year-old child in Storm Lake nearly 5 years ago. Harney Dosalua, age 36, had entered Alford pleas in May in Buena Vista County District Court to two counts of lascivious acts with a child. In an Alford plea, defendant does not admit guilt, but the judge enters a guilty plea into the record. Charges of second-degree sexual abuse and lascivious conduct with minor were dismissed as part of a plea agreement. After he's released from prison, he will be required to register with the Iowa Sex Offender Registry. And District Judge Nancy Wittenberg also ordered him to serve a lifetime special sex offender sentence after he completes his prison sentence. If he were to violate the terms of this special sentence, he could be sent back to prison. The Storm Lake Police Department received a report of a sexual assault February 16 of 2022. An investigation revealed that the child was assaulted in December 2018 in a home in the 500 block of College Avenue. Dasalua was arrested February 24, 2022. Next brief. A 15-year-old boy, Dateline Lamar's, a 15-year-old boy is facing a felony charge in connection with a hit-and-run pedestrian accident in Lamar's on Sunday, which seriously injured a woman. The teen, who was not identified by police, was arrested 10 a.m. Tuesday on a charge of leaving the scene of an accident, which is a Class D felony. Police Chief Kevin Vandevecht said in a statement that the accident was reported at 7:23 p.m. Sunday at the intersection of 6th Avenue and 4th Street Southwest. Brandy Moll, S-M-O-L-L, age 45, of Lamar's, was struck by a vehicle while she was walking westbound in the north crosswalk of the intersection. The vehicle, a newer model, red four-door pickup, fled the scene, traveling southbound on 6th Avenue Southwest. Moll was taken by ambulance to Floyd Valley Healthcare in Lamar's and was later flown to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center in Sioux City. Video from various businesses and private parties helped authorities identify the vehicle as a 2003 Chevy Silverado 2500 and track its movements, according to Vandevecht. While on patrol, a Lamar's police officer located the suspect vehicle, which, quote, showed evidence of the collision, Vandevecht said. The vehicle was seized, and the 15-year-old boy was subsequently taken into custody, charged, taken to juvenile detention. This incident remains under investigation. Up next in briefs, Dateline Sioux City. Man accused of striking woman in head with pistol. A Sioux City man was arrested Tuesday for allegedly striking a woman in the head with a pistol and threatening her life. The Sioux City Police Department said in a statement that Robert Anthony Steiner II, age 31, was arrested on a charge of domestic abuse assault, third or subsequent offense. That's a Class D felony. At 7 a.m. Tuesday, officers were dispatched to the 1300 block of West 3rd Street for a report of a domestic assault. On the scene, officers found the 31-year-old victim, who had injuries to her head. The statement said she reported that Steiner struck her several times in the head with a pistol and threatened to kill her. The incident occurred while a 2-year-old was sleeping in another room, according to the statement. After the assault, the statement said that Steiner left the scene on foot. Officers found him inside a residence in the 200 block of Rebecca Street. And that's it for local news in the Sioux City Journal today. We'll turn over to page 3, Nation and World. In the digest, judge says Trump can be on Michigan primary ballot. Dateline Detroit. A Michigan judge ruled Tuesday that former President Donald Trump will remain on the state's primary ballot, dealing a blow to the effort to stop Trump's candidacy with a Civil War era constitutional clause. Court of Claims Judge James Redford rejected arguments that Trump's role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol meant that the court had to declare him ineligible for the presidency. Redford wrote that because Trump followed state law in qualifying for the primary ballot, he cannot remove the former president. He also said it should be up to Congress to decide whether Trump is disqualified under the section of the U.S. Constitution that bars a person from office who is engaged in insurrection. It is the second time in a week that a state court has declined to remove Trump from a primary ballot under the 14th Amendment. Next brief, supermarket shooting suspect pleads insanity. Dateline Boulder. The defendant in a 2021 mass shooting at a Colorado supermarket pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity Tuesday, as a judge ruled the case can move to trial after testimony that the suspect killed 8 of his 10 victims in just over a minute using a gun with a high-capacity magazine. Attorneys for Ahmed Alawi Alissa entered the plea on his behalf before District Court Judge Ingrid Bakke in Boulder, Colorado. A plea of not guilty by reason of insanity means defense attorneys claim mental illness prevented Alissa from understanding right from wrong when a crime was committed. If successful, it could allow Alissa to avoid prison and instead be committed indefinitely to the state mental hospital. New revelations Tuesday included that the suspect kept notes on his iPhone about guns and how to move and shoot people. And then we have some more briefs. Military nominees. Senate Democrats pushed ahead Tuesday with a resolution that would allow the quick confirmation of hundreds of military nominees, an attempt to maneuver around a blockade from Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama over a Pentagon abortion policy. The next one, economy. The Labor Department reported Tuesday that inflation in the United States slowed last month, a sign the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes are continuing to cool consumer price spikes. Next, Korean tensions. North Korea said Wednesday it successfully tested new solid fuel engines designed for intermediate-range ballistic missiles as it continues to work on developing nuclear-capable weapons targeting its rivals in the region. Next, fraud. Sam Meal, a former fundraiser for U.S. Representative George Santos, pleaded guilty Tuesday to a federal wire fraud charge, admitting he impersonated a high-ranking congressional aide while raising campaign cash for the embattled New York Republican. Next one, Mexico. A court in Mexico sentenced 11 former police officers to 50 years in prison each for the 2021 slayings of 17 migrants and two Mexican citizens, authorities said Tuesday. A 12th officer was convicted only of abuse of authority and sentenced to 19 years in prison. And the final brief, Dateline Ukraine. European Union nations acknowledged Tuesday they may fail on a promise to provide 1 million rounds of ammunition to Ukraine by spring of 2024 to help stave off Russia's invasion and win back occupied territory. Here's a small article. House votes to prevent government shutdown. New speaker forced to compromise with Democrats on package. Dateline Washington. The House voted Tuesday to prevent a government shutdown after new Speaker Mike Johnson was forced to reach across the aisle to Democrats when hard-right conservatives revolted against his plan. The bipartisan tally was 336 to 95, and it showed Johnson's willingness to leave his right-flank Republicans behind and work with Democrats to temporarily keep the government running, the same political move that cost former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy his job just a few weeks ago. Under his proposal, Johnson put forward a unique two-part process that temporarily funds some federal agencies to January 19th and others to February 2. It's a continuing resolution that comes without any of the deep cuts conservatives have demanded all year. It also fails to include President Joe Biden's request for nearly $106 billion for Ukraine, Israel, border security, and other supplemental funds. Johnson, who announced his endorsement Tuesday of Donald Trump as the Republican nominee for president, hit the airwaves to sell his approach and met privately Monday night with the Conservative Freedom Caucus. Next story, supporters of Israel rally in D.C. Officials designate the demonstration a level one security event. And then there's a sidebar showing that what that is. And it says the Homeland Security Department designated the march a level one security event, the highest classification in its system, and one usually used for Super Bowl and other major events, two law enforcement officials said. The designation means the event required substantial law enforcement assistance from federal agencies, the officials said. The FBI and Homeland Security sent a joint bulletin to law enforcement officials in Washington warning about the potential for violence or an attack, the officials said. But the bulletin said clearly that federal officials did not identify any specific actionable threat. And then the text of the article, Dateline Washington, supporters of Israel rallied by the tens of thousands on the National Mall under heavy security Tuesday, voicing solidarity in the fight against Hamas and crying, "Never again." The March for Israel offered a resounding and bipartisan endorsement of one of America's closest allies as criticism intensifies over Israel's war in Gaza, set off by the Hamas incursion on October 7th. Overlooking a sea of Israeli and U.S. flags, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York came together on the stage with House Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana and Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. They joined hands as Schumer chanted, "We stand with Israel." Yet underneath that projection of unity, Democrats are divided over Israel's course and its treatment of Palestinians. President Joe Biden is now urging Israel to restrain some of its tactics to ease civilian suffering in Gaza after voicing full-throated solidarity with the Israelis in the war's earlier weeks. A succession of speakers took to the stage to denounce the Hamas attack and what they said was a virulent spread of anti-Semitism internationally. Quote, "an embarrassment to all civilized people and nations," unquote, in the words of Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who addressed the crowd by video from the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Hamas militants stormed into Israel from Gaza in the surprise incursion October 7th, killing more than 1,200 people and taking more than 200 hostages, according to Israeli officials. Israel responded with weeks of attacks in Gaza, which so far killed more than 11,000 people, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. The Homeland Security Department designated the march a level one security event. And then I explained that before. That designation means the event required substantial law enforcement assistance from federal agencies, officials said. The FBI and Homeland Security sent a joint bulletin to law enforcement officials in Washington, warning about the potential for violence or an attack. But the bulletin said clearly they didn't identify any specific actionable threat. And final story on the Nation and World page, Israel Army in hospital. And this will probably be outdated by the time you hear this. Officials say they're using targeted attacks inside besieged facility. And this is Dateline Gaza Strip. The Israel military entered Gaza's largest hospital early Wednesday, conducting what it called, quote, "a precise and targeted operation against Hamas in a specified area of the facility, which has been the site of a standoff with the militant group." Israeli authorities claim the militants conceal military operations in the Shifa hospital, but with hundreds of patients and medical personnel inside, the military previously refrained from entering. In recent weeks, Israeli Defense Forces publicly warned that such use of the hospital, quote, "jeopardizes its protected status under international law," the military said. Tuesday, military officials conveyed again to Gaza authorities that all military activity in the hospital must cease within 12 hours. Unfortunately, it did not, the military said. Hamas denied the Israeli accusations that it uses the hospital for cover. Israeli military officials said they were taking steps to avoid harm to civilians. The operation unfolded after the military seized broader control of northern Gaza on Tuesday. The army said it captured the territory's legislature building, the Hamas police headquarters, and a compound housing Hamas military intelligence headquarters, gains that carry high symbolic value in the country's quest to crush the ruling Hamas group, but the strategic value was unclear. Meanwhile, Israeli defense officials said they agreed to allow fuel shipments into the Gaza Strip for humanitarian operations. It's the first time Israel allowed fuel into the besieged territory since Hamas's bloody invasion of Israel on October 7th. In a nationally televised news conference, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Hamas, quote, lost control of northern Gaza and Israel made significant gains in Gaza City. Asked about the time frame for the war, he said, we're talking about long months, not a day or two. For days, the Israeli army encircled Shifa Hospital. Hundreds of patients, staff, and displaced people were trapped inside, with supplies dwindling and no electricity to run incubators and other life-saving equipment. After days without refrigeration, morgue staff said on Tuesday that they dug a mass grave in the yard for more than 120 bodies. Elsewhere, the Palestinian Red Crescent said Tuesday it evacuated patients, doctors, and displaced families from another Gaza City hospital called Al-Quds, spelled Q-U-D-S. And that's all we have for news today in the Sioux City Journal. We'll turn over to sports with the reminder that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We're so glad to have you listening. You can listen to this and many other local programs on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We'll start sports with What to Watch Wednesday. I guess this isn't just sports. This is lots of stuff. So beginning at 6:30, NHL hockey. Philadelphia Flyers are at the Carolina Hurricanes, and the New York Islanders head to Vancouver to face the Canucks. That's at 6:30 on TNT. Catch a Classic, 90th Anniversary Films on Turner Classic Movies at 7. First up, romantic drama, Man's Castle. Miriam Hopkins stars as a woman in the middle of a love triangle between two men played by Gary Cooper and Frederick March in the romance comedy Designed for Living. And then on the Discovery Channel at 8, Expedition Unknown. Season premiere, globetrotting explorer Josh Gates is back scanning the depths of the ocean, trekking into the heart of Central American jungles and diving into flooded tunnels, no thank you, beneath an active volcano in search of answers to the world's greatest mysteries. And now we'll turn to sports. There's really nothing local in the paper today, so we'll do some national stuff. College football. Georgia rises to the top. Bulldogs, coming off another impressive win, leapfrog the Buckeyes. Dateline Athens, Georgia. The Georgia Bulldogs are back on top, not that they ever really left. The two-time defending national champion Bulldogs, 10-0 and 7-0 in the SEC, still haven't lost a game, and they've been ranked number one in the Associated Press poll for an SEC record 22 weeks in a row. But the college football playoff selection, committed for the first time this season, sees Georgia as the nation's number one team. The 13-member group arrived at that decision in their third vote of the year on Tuesday. Georgia was number two behind Ohio State in the previous two rankings, which began October 31st. The Buckeyes, 10-0, slipped back to number two, with fellow Big Ten member Michigan at number three and Florida State number four. The top four teams are all undefeated. The top eight teams in the rankings won last week, and the committee's only changes among that group were at the very top. The consensus among the panelists on Tuesday night's broadcast and selection show was the Bulldogs' schedule simply allowed them to finally show their strength. In the last 2 weeks, Georgia defeated number 12 Missouri, which moved up to number 9 this week, and number 9 Ole Miss, which dropped to 13 after Saturday's 52-17 loss at the hands of the Bulldogs. Quote, I think you just look at the games, the win last week over Missouri, and then the Mississippi game, committee chair Boo Corrigan said. It's tied 14 in all, and they go on a 38-3 run and kind of showed their dominance both on offense and on defense against a really strong Mississippi offense, unquote. The Bulldogs carried a 27-game winning streak to Knoxville Saturday to take on Tennessee. No team with two losses has ever made the college football playoffs. And then we've got the top 10. Number 10, Louisville. Number 9, Missouri. Number 8, Alabama. Number 7, Texas. Number 6, Oregon. Number 5, Washington. Number 4, Florida State. Number 3, Michigan. Number 2, Ohio State. And of course, number 1 is Georgia. And we'll jump over to baseball. Orioles Hyde, Marlins Shoemaker win Manager of the Year honors. Brandon Hyde was voted American League Manager of the Year on Tuesday night after guiding the Baltimore Orioles to an AL best 101 victories just 2 years after a 110-loss season. Miami's Skip Shoemaker won the National League Award in voting by the Baseball Writers Association of America. Hyde led Baltimore out of a difficult rebuild in which the Orioles improved to 83-79 in 2022 when Hyde finished second in voting to Cleveland's Terry Francona. Baltimore was more than ready to take the next step this season thanks to a sparkling core of young talent. Infielder Gunnar Henderson was a unanimous AL Rookie of the Year Monday night. Hyde earned 27 of 30 first-place votes, with Bruce Bochy of Texas receiving the other three. Two-time winner Kevin Cash of the Tampa Bay finished third. Schumacher led Miami to an 84-78 record, including 33-14 in one-run games in his first season at the helm. Shoemaker defeated Milwaukee's Craig Counsell, who left to manage the Chicago Cubs last week, and Atlanta's Brian Snitker in a tight race. Padres owner dies. San Diego Padres owner Pete Seidler, a third-generation member of the O'Malley family who used to own the Brooklyn Los Angeles Dodgers, died on Tuesday. He was 63. The owner and chairman of the club, Seidler, dismissed the notion that San Diego was a small market and constantly redirected questions about how the Padres could sustain their big spending ways on players like Manny Machado, Xander Bogaerts, and Fernando Tatis Jr. A cause of death was not disclosed. Seidler was a two-time cancer survivor. The team announced in mid-September that Seidler had an unspecified medical procedure in August. Peter Seidler and his brother Tom, as well as cousins Kevin and Brian O'Malley, bought into the Padres in 2012 with advice and support from Peter O'Malley, who owned the Los Angeles Dodgers from 1979 to 1998. Peter O'Malley's father, Walter, moved the franchise from Brooklyn to Los Angeles in 1958. Stay in Oakland. A devoted group of Bay Area baseball fans have sent Stay in Oakland boxes to 15 Major League Baseball team owners, imploring them to vote no on the team's planned relocation to Las Vegas. The group targeted owners who could be swayed to vote against the proposed move during league meetings this week. The list includes Boston's John Henry and the New York Yankees' Hal Steinbrenner. The boxes contained green A's caps, baseball cards featuring the owners' likenesses, and a note detailing why they should vote against Las Vegas. College basketball top 25. Number 9 Duke handles Michigan State. And it shows a photo of Duke center Kyle Filipowski taking a free throw after being fouled by Michigan State guard A.J. Hogard during the first half of Tuesday's game. Dateline Chicago. Caleb Foster scored 18 points. Kyle Filipowski added 15. And number 9 Duke beat number 18 Michigan State 74-65 in the Champions Classic on Tuesday night. The Blue Devils withstood several pushes by the Spartans after grabbing an 11-point halftime lead in the first game of a powerhouse doubleheader. Foster scored all but two of his points in the second half, including back-to-back three-pointers, to expand Duke's lead to 68-56 with just under 2 minutes remaining. He was 7 of 8 from the field and 4 of 5 from beyond the arc. Filipowski, who scored 25 points in each of Duke's first 2 games, had 10 points in the second half. The preseason All-American grabbed 8 rebounds. Mark Mitchell and Tyrese Proctor each scored 13 points as the Blue Devils bounced back from a home loss to then number 12 Arizona last week. They also gave coach John Shire a win in front of his hometown crowd. He starred at Glenbrook North High School, about 25 miles from the United Center in Northbrook, Illinois, before becoming an All-American player and longtime assistant for Hall of Famer Mike Krzyzewski. Tyler Walker led Michigan State with 22 points, and Malik Hall scored 18. The Spartans shot 6 of 19 on three-pointers after going 2 for 31 during their first 2 games, a season-opening loss to James Madison and a blowout win over Southern Indiana. Number 1 Kansas 89, number 17 Kentucky 84. Hunter Dickinson had 27 points, 21 rebounds, and the Jayhawks, 3-0, outlasted the Wildcats, 2-1, in Tuesday's second game of the Champions Classic. DeJuan Harris Jr. added 23 points for the Jayhawks, who trailed by as many as 14 in the second half. KJ Adams Jr. scored 16 points, and Kevin McCullough Jr. finished with 12 points and 10 assists. Kansas closed the game with an 11-1 run. Antonio Reeves scored 24 points for Kentucky, but he went 3 for 17 from three-point range. Adu Tierro finished with 16 points and 13 boards. Number 4 Marquette 71, number 23 Illinois 64. Tyler Kolek shook off an ankle injury to score 24 points, and Marquette beat host Illinois. The reigning Big East Player of the Year, Kolek added 6 rebounds and 4 assists. Cam Jones scored 15 for the Golden Eagles, 3-0, and Oso Igodaro had 13 points and 8 rebounds. Number 5, UConn, 87, Missouri Valley, 53. Mississippi Valley, rather. Cam Spencer scored 19 of his 25 points in the first half to lead Connecticut over visiting Mississippi Valley State. Donovan Klingon added 17 points for the Huskies, 3-0, who have won 20 straight non-conference games, all by double digits. Alex Caraban chipped in with 14 points, despite spending most of the game in foul trouble. Number 7, Tennessee, 82, Wofford, 61. Dalton Necht scored 18 points to lead Tennessee over visiting Wofford. The Northern Colorado transfer scored all but 4 of his points in the second half, helping the Volunteers, 3-0, pull away from the Terriers after leading by just 5 at halftime. Number 8, Creighton, 92, Iowa, 84. Trey Alexander narrowly missed a triple-double with 23 points, 11 rebounds, and 9 assists. An 8th-ranked Creighton put on a shooting exhibition coming out of halftime before holding off Iowa. Creighton, 3-0, made 15 of its first 17 shots to start the second half. Number 10, Florida Atlantic, 100, East Michigan, 57. Vladislav Golden scored 19 points. Brandon Weatherspoon added 16 while not missing a shot. And Florida Atlantic eased past Eastern Michigan. Number 11, Gonzaga, 123 points. East Oregon, 57. Graham Ike had 25 points, 11 rebounds in just 18 minutes. And Gonzaga beat visiting Eastern Oregon in a tune-up for the Maui Invitational. Number 13, Texas A&M, 79, SMU, 66. Tyrese Radford scored 16 of his 21 points in the first half. Henry Coleman III had 13 points, 15 rebounds, and Texas A&M beat SMU in a meeting of old Southwest Conference foes in Dallas. Number 22, Alabama, 102 points, South Alabama, 46. Mark Sears scored 17 points. Sam Walters added 16 to help Alabama beat visiting South Alabama. And number 25, Colorado, 106. Milwaukee, 79. KJ Simpson scored 23 points. Eddie Lampkin Jr. had 14 and 12 rebounds. And Colorado rode a torrid long-range shooting performance to a rout of Milwaukee in Boulder, Colorado. Another sports story. By the way, there were no opinions or obituaries today in the Sioux City Journal. Back to sports. Saleh's loyalty to QB isn't helping the Jets win. This is in NFL Notes. Robert Saleh's loyalty is not helping the New York Jets win games. Saleh is sticking with Zach Wilson at quarterback, even though the Jets have not reached the end zone on 36 consecutive drives. Saleh insists Wilson isn't the only problem, and he won't make a change simply for a spark. His logic is reasonable. The offense commits too many penalties. Players drop passes and linemen miss blocks. It's hard to put all the blame on one guy, but the Jets would be in a better position to make a playoff push if their offense wasn't dismal. Quarterbacks get too much credit and too much blame, but numbers don't lie. No touchdowns over 11 quarters justifies trying something new. Many coaches have benched quarterbacks who've been far more productive than Wilson this season. Nobody would blame Saleh if he gave Trevor Siemian a shot. The Jets realized they couldn't contend with Wilson, so they traded for Aaron Rodgers. They went back to Wilson after Rodgers tore an Achilles tendon in week one, and while he is showing improvement, it's not working. In a surprising move, the Jets waived running back Michael Carter, who had a promising rookie season, but has had a rough second season, which saw his role reduced mainly to third down duties. NFL Briefs, Bills. Buffalo fired defensive coordinator Ken Dorsey with the Josh Allen-led attack stagnating over a six-week stretch, and the three-time defending AFC East champions are falling further out of the playoff picture. The move came a day after a 24-22 loss to Denver in an outing where Allen committed three of the Bills' four turnovers. Jaguars. According to the police report, Jacksonville receiver Zay Jones got into a custody argument with the mother of his child and left fingernail scratches on her neck. Browns. Cleveland star running back Nick Chubb had surgery Wednesday to repair the torn anterior ligament in his left knee, a season-ending injury he sustained in week two at Pittsburgh. Texans. Houston linebacker Denzel Perryman has been suspended without pay for three games for repeatedly violating player safety rules during Sunday's win over Cincinnati. Perryman can appeal the suspension. Cowboys. Dallas linebacker Leighton Vander Esch is likely to miss the rest of the season with a neck injury that sidelined him in the past month. His career could be in jeopardy as well. Vikings. Minnesota signed linebacker Anthony Barr to its practice squad. The Vikings are bringing back their 2014 first-round draft pick and four-time Pro Bowl pick for depth after an injury to leading tackler Jordan Hicks. Hicks bruised his right shin in Minnesota's win on Sunday over New Orleans. He developed a condition called compartment syndrome, which is caused by a pressure buildup from internal bleeding or swollen tissues. And one final sports piece, Nets Simmons out with pinched nerve. Ben Simmons will miss at least another week because of a pinched nerve, the Brooklyn Nets guard's latest back trouble. Simmons has missed the past three games because of a bruised left hip, but after continued discomfort in the area, the Nets said Tuesday that Simmons had an MRI exam that revealed a nerve impingement in the lower left side of his back. Quote, Ben was day-to-day. He was improving, said coach Jacques Vaughn before the Nets game against the Orlando Magic. Quote, it's got to a point where obviously he wasn't playing, so we wanted to be extremely thorough. So he got an MRI, which showed a left side impingement. Back problems have ended the past two seasons early for Simmons, who will continue to receive treatment on both his back and his hip. Vaughn said Simmons' current injury is not the same as the one that cost him the final 24 games of last season, but he would not rule out that they were related. And that's all the time we have today for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, November 15th, 2023. I've been your reader, Mary Francis. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for people with print disabilities. We're so glad to have you listening. Have a great day.